Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, the Free Markets series. You're about to meet a fascinating guest, Father Robert Sirico. That's right, Father Sirico, a man of the cloth, a man of God, a man of the gospel, and that's what he preaches, the gospel. He is not preaching about the economy or society, and yet he has deeply held convictions in that realm and has a lot to say. That's what led him to write Defending the Free Market, the Moral Case for a Free Economy. Father Sirico, it should be said, was once, long ago, a fellow traveler, as the term goes, of people such as Tom Hayden and Jane Fonda in their radical early days. He turned back to the church, to the faith of his youth, and turned to a different view of the economy. He'll explain all that. Here he is. Father Sirico, welcome. And we're discussing your book, so I'm going to quote, and this will take us back to a different time. It'll be fun. I grew up in a family of six in a small apartment above Coney Island Ave, Brooklyn. Both my parents had jobs, my father spending blistering days on the roofs of various buildings, spreading tar and laying the hot black paper. My mother waiting tables, doing factory work, and working as a cashier in a department store. We did not own a car in those days, to my memory, and I was the first of the siblings to grow up with a TV, a heavy brown box that got three stations, if you were lucky. We had enough to eat. I went to school, as had my siblings before me. If there were government handouts to be had, I never heard of them. I also never felt deprived, far from it. As I love to tell people, you only had to walk down one flight of stairs from our two-bedroom apartment and onto the busy avenue to put yourself in the middle of a spontaneous, multi-ethnic experiment with a veritable smorgasbord of smells and accents and cultures all on display. Here we were, a diverse group in many ways, but sharing certain traits in common. The households were, for the most part, headed by hard-working first- or second-generation immigrants, all sweating their way up the economic ladder. There was absolutely no consciousness of poverty. Instead, there was a lot of talk of hustling, which did not have the same connotation of dishonesty as it does today. And besides, we had the Dodgers. I stopped there because you lost the Dodgers. And I've been told often for Brooklynites that's a tragedy.
Tragedy.
Still
I'm still waiting for them to come back.
Yeah, and they might. It's Brooklyn is a little richer than it was in the past few years.
Yeah, that was 56.
But this was a great time. And, of course, some people might say, oh, well, nostalgia for an America long gone. But many people want to see that come back in one way or another. The family structure, the neighborhood structure, the absence of crime, and a certain prosperity and a certain self-reliance. And those are the values in your book.
But even below that, there was this sense of a shared ethic. Not denominational, not explicitly theological, but a shared ethic of hard work, of belief in God, of a respect for your neighbor, even if it was sometimes politically incorrect in the way you expressed it.
And you say no government handouts to be had, and that takes us to our central theme.
Yes.
You don't see that as, there's no such thing as government charity, quote unquote, there's such thing as personal charity.
Well, right, I mean, bureaucrats are not charitable, right? They're functionaries. They're doing a job, and even the best interpretation wouldn't call it charity as such. You might call it justice, and we could have a discussion about that. But no, a charity is something that comes from a person's heart. It's a sacrifice on the part of an individual or a group of individuals that is voluntarily engaged in.
And the idea, since we're talking about free markets as well, the idea that free markets and greater freedom in the economic structure from government, sometimes from union bureaucracies, the idea that that is very compatible with your faith and, as a matter of fact, flows from it, let's talk about that because some people will be surprised.
Well, yes, because where does the money come from? If you're going to be charitable, where did that money come from? I mean, the government redistributes money. People create money. They are engaged in a free market process. And I need to challenge another idea. And this, some people initially will think this is outright heresy, but the normative way in which the poor are raised from their poverty is not through charity. Charity is the exception. It's not the norm. Charity is made possible because people are engaged in economically productive actions. And so charity is there to help people in emergency situations. And if we refocus that whole ethic and think of it as a government function and as a normative force by which wealth is redistributed, then you in effect, kill the goose that lays the golden egg.
And these are truths that you arrived at, beliefs that you arrived at over time, starting from a horizon.
Yes.
This will get people's attention. A horizon that included Jane Fonda and Tom Hayden. I read that.
Yes.
You were buddies with really the left wing. You were
the new left. New left. I wouldn't have called myself an orthodox Marxist, but it was fashionable. I was involved. From that memory that you just read from the book, I drifted from my faith. And even left New York City. From the age of 13 to about 27, I was away from the Catholic faith. And in the early 70s, I was involved in various new left-wing movements in Southern California, largely because of my belief in human dignity. I wouldn't have called it that at the time, but it was freedom, it was justice.
Vietnam War,
the beginnings of the gay movement, the beginnings of the feminist movement. At that time in California, we had the farm workers boycott of Gallo
Chavez,
wine, Chavez, Cesar Chavez, and but then somebody gave me some books to read, and it really opened my mind. I was astounded to realize that redistribution of the wealth, even if you did it globally, would not substantially improve the well-being of the poor. It would certainly, if you're very poor and you have all the wealth redistributed, would raise a few people up temporarily. But the shocking thing, and I can't believe it now that I didn't consider this, is that in a radical redistribution of the wealth, especially wealth that is invested in the means of production, as Karl Marx would say, you have eviscerated the infrastructure of economic productivity, i.e. businesses. And so when I came to understand that, I began to look more deeply into the question of private property and what this really meant. And there I discovered, and you know, became very clear to me, that it's not the ability or the right to own a physical object in itself as much as it is the right of my relationship with resources.
To do something with them.
To do something with them. So it's the investment of my life, my intelligence, my courage to risk, all of these things that establishes a relationship between the human person and resources, which are not wealth. Mm-hmm. Resources have to be transformed into something that serves the community. When it serves the community, people put a price on it, and that's what becomes wealth.
And the idea that we should all be productive, you know, to eat, you know, that we all have our, well, there's the parable of the talents in the gospel. That idea is I think very easily understood and compatible, quote unquote, in the general opinion with religion. But accumulating a lot of it, becoming filthy rich, there we have a disconnect.
Rich, that's an interesting concept.
Yeah, there we have trouble with that. And after all, in the gospel, it says, you know, it's easier for a man to pass through the eye of the needle than a rich man
to get into the kingdom of heaven. And then I'm asked that almost everywhere I go. And I always ask an audience when that question comes up, even religious audiences, what does Jesus say after that?
Nobody knows.
You know what he says?
No, I've forgot.
With man, it is impossible, but with God, all things are possible. Wealth is an extension of liberty, in effect. So what that means is that we have more opportunities. More opportunities mean that we have the opportunity to do evil or the opportunity to do good. So yes, it is true that it is difficult for a person with an expanded amount of opportunities to make wrong choices. So there is a danger to vast wealth if you don't use it properly. In the same way that there's a danger to engaging our freedom. Freedom, liberty, is not a virtue. It's the context in which virtue is possible, but not guaranteed, because in the same context of liberty, you can abuse your liberty. You can do vile things. As I quote in the book, a friend of mine who's deceased now, the market is really the place where all kinds of values are on display, not just good values, not just virtuous values. My contention isn't that the free market is canonized by theology or by the church or by the scriptures, but that it affords us the greatest opportunity to do good, especially when it's combined with an ethical premise, an ethical system, an understanding of the rich complexity and moral nature of human beings.
And close to what I what you just commented on and I brought up is this other seeming contradiction, greed versus self-interest. This comes up all the time when people look at morality and capitalism and they say, well, where does one stop and where does it, you know, Gordon Gekko versus somebody, you know, building a good company and giving out jobs. There's a difference.
Right. Well, there is, of course. And what does greed mean? Greed is the disordered sense of desire. We all desire. Human beings are desiring beings. At the end of the day, you're hungry, you desire a meal. But when that desire becomes disordered, when it becomes inordinate, as we'd say in theology, this is a perversion of the legitimate desire to be better. And remember, too, that greed, in a theological sense, is not just for material objects. Mm-hmm. It's also for status. It's also for prestige. Dante has lots of popes and bishops in hell, in the inferno, because of their greed and their arrogance and their pride. St. Augustine once said, in reference to the story of the rich man and Lazarus, you remember where the rich man is feasting sumptuously and Lazarus is laying at his feet and the dog is licking his wounds. And then in the end, the rich man is in the flames of hell and Lazarus is in the bosom of Abraham. St. Augustine said about that, that this tells us something not about money, that the rich man was not in hell because he was rich, but because he was proud. Mm-hmm. And Lazarus was not in heaven because he was poor, but because he was humble.
And so do you find the skepticism, because you've alluded to it, when you are reconciling your beliefs with what the general opinion on religion is or should be, do you find that skepticism, that finally the message is getting through, it's easier to vanquish that than in the old days, or not?
Oh, yes. No, I've been involved in these kinds of ideas. As I say, when I entered seminary, I had already, so we're talking 30, 35 years now since I had, even more since I had my conversion. And I think now the ideas are much more mainstream. People are beginning to understand that we can't create a utopia just by wishing it into existence, that we can't abolish the right to private property, that if we do, we create economic disaster. And that should concern people especially who are morally sensitive, because the first people who are going to be hit by economic policies that are deleterious, by wealth redistribution schemes, by inflationary policies,
and the first person, engineering.
Social engineering, and all the rest of it, the kind of concentration of power in the political sphere, the first person hit by this is going to be the poor. And I think in the name of the poor, we have to create economic systems of prosperity, and that is, generally speaking, free trade, respect for private property, the rule of law, and as I said earlier, all of this wrapped in an ethical system. And by ethical, that can be pretty broadly understood ecumenically.
But that flies in the face of something that was, I suppose, an easy sell called liberation theology, especially in Latin America. It's an easy sell because you seem to be entirely with the poor, and so was Jesus, and you're with the downtrodden, and, you know, the Sermon on the Mount. And so what's wrong with liberation theology?
Well, what's wrong with liberation theology is that it didn't work. I mean, where it had its greatest chance in Nicaragua, it was a manifest failure. It was really, liberation theology is a form of Christian error that goes back centuries into the even the 12th century. There were a group of radical Franciscans who called for the abolition of private property. Mm-hmm. The problem with liberation theology, which is largely the baptism of Karl Marx, is the same thing, the same problem with socialism and planned economic orchestration in general, is that it has a failure to be able to calculate what the real cost of things are. Imagine if we went through life not knowing what the real cost of something is. The fact that we don't know what the real cost of it is doesn't mean there isn't a real cost to it. Mm-hmm. And so you had the phenomenon, for instance, in Central Europe under the Soviet Union, where you'd see long lines of people. Yeah. And then you'd come in and they'd have tons of size 13 shoes and very few in the average size that people would wear. Why is that? Because people didn't express their preferences by buying.
Of course, there was a plan or something.
It was a plan to do it. And so that line is the symbol of rationing. They had to ration. What the market does in a far more subtle and easier way is ration goods and services so that if a thing is of a higher price, people know, maybe I shouldn't buy this now. Maybe I should save up for it. Maybe, you know, that means it's rarer. Mm-hmm. It means that it isn't
the price will come down.
And then the price will come down and everybody will buy it because then now I can buy it and I can buy a few extra. Mm-hmm. And those are cues to the producers to say, let's produce more of these, let's produce less of these. And that's why liberation theology was a problem. It also had a misconception of who Jesus was. Jesus was not a revolutionary. It is true that our Lord identified with the poor and had a preferential love for the poor. But nowhere in the scriptures does he call on the government to do things.
No, certainly not the government of his day.
Certainly not the government of his day.
But render unto Caesar. He has a marvelous way of...
power from authority. Authority is something that is interior. Both power and authority are forms of constraint. But authority is an internal constraint that a person acquiesces to the authority. Power is external form of constraint where the government tells you to do it or some superior power tells you to do it. Even in the story of the Good Samaritan, which is the paradigm of charitable engagement, I hear people very often say, well, that's the Jesus endorsement of the welfare state. Where's the state in this? The whole point of it is that this Samaritan gives to this man, tends to his wounds, puts him on his own animal, brings him to a hotel, puts him in, and in effect gives the innkeeper a credit card. Of course, not literally. But he says, when I come back, let me know if there's any added expense and I'll pay you for it. How is that the welfare state?
No, you're right. And I was going to ask you, in retrospect, it was, depending on your point of view, either lucky or divinely inspired for the church that John Paul II came along when he did, because he was from the totalitarian system.
Yes,
and
he had
fought it.
But
imagine if we'd had from Brazil somebody with liberation credentials.
Or from Europe.
Yeah, and it could have gone the other way.
Right, yeah.
And John Paul initially was met with a lot of skepticism on that.
He was, well, not only skepticism, but I won't name the name, but there was even a Canadian theologian who, when John Paul first ascended the throne of Peter, wrote a whole book and a commentary on Laborum Exercens, which was one of his first encyclical, in which he says, there's a new opportunity for Christian Marxist dialogue because this man understands Marxism. It was a complete, it's an embarrassing book to the commentary to read now, because especially in retrospect, to see that this was the man who would bring down communism in effect. I mean, there were a lot of other factors, but a Slavic pope who basically challenged the whole empire of the Soviet Union morally and theologically really had a lot to do with that. Reagan and Thatcher played their roles as well.
And our topic is not international intrigue.
Okay, right.
But
right.
No, but I'm going to ask you a question on international intrigue, just to see if you have any info on it. It is said that those powers in Eastern Europe did plan to harm John Paul II. It's never proven, but that Bulgarian secret services and others, and of course there wasn't one attempt. Do you believe that?
I think, I know that people high up in the Vatican believe that, and they're not inclined to sensationalize the thing. I know, and this is just an anecdote, shortly after the fall of communism, I was at a conference and was sharing some conversation with a man who was in the intelligence of the German intelligence, German intelligence.
BND.
Yeah, and he happened to be in Poland on the day of the election of the Pope, and he was meeting with high-level Polish intelligence, which was largely Soviet-dominated at that time. And word came in, there was whispering going on, and the German fellow said, What's happening? And all he heard was the Polish guy say, Holy Mother of God. So that was their reaction.
Of course. They could not have been happy. And indeed, events. But it's always remained a mystery whether or not they actively had the gall to sort of think of bringing them down.
I think the consensus of historians and people who know that period, especially George Weigel in his book Witness to Hope, that's probably the most exhaustive study of John Paul's life and had access, direct access to the Pope, would have said yes, there were.
And others watching us may think, well, that's all well and good. John Paul won the fight, quote unquote, yes, there, but lost it on when he tried to impose on contraception and other issues. He just hasn't been able to change the behavior even of Catholics. Is that true?
I think, yes. I think what happened after the Second Vatican Council was this false notion that everything was up for grabs. That, by the way, was part of the reason I left the church. It just didn't seem like it had an identity. It was eroding. Of course, John Paul II didn't enforce anything new. He just maintained the position of the church for 2,000 years mm-hmm. on this subject. And by the way, the position of all the Christian churches up until about 1931 was, if we're talking about contraception. But yes, I think
and or abortion.
Abortion too is a first century thing. In fact, both contraception, abortion, and I'll add divorce were the reasons that women, in aristocratic women in Rome, were attracted to Christianity. The reason that Christianity made such an impact on Rome, because these things were seen in that context as liberating to women. Women no longer saw themselves as the chattel of men because they couldn't just be divorced and dismissed. Many of those women had to abort children or give them up for being
adoption.
Exposed. No,
oh,
no
to,
being
to,
exposed.
To death, yeah.
Against their will, because the husband didn't want another mouth to feed. And also, the whole point of contraception meant that the woman had some rights in this relationship. So those were part and parcel of the church's initial attraction to the aristocratic classes. But I think you're right to say that in the period of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, there was a manifest failure to communicate the reasons for the church's teaching, the dignity mm-hmm. Of the sexual act, both interior to the church in terms of our own catechesis, but also with regard to some of our priests.
And worst of all, this is going to be my last question on these social issues, because taking
sure.
us away from our central
sure.
theme, is of course the scandals within religious communities
yes.
that keep appearing
and priests
and being
yeah.
dug up.
Yeah.
That's hard to live down.
It is very hard to live down, and rightly so. The betrayal of priests, of their vows, the failure of vocations, the failure of seminaries, the failure of bishops to govern their priests properly is a manifest scandal and sin equivalent to that of Judas' own betrayal of Jesus. And the scriptures have some very potent things to say to those who bring about scandal to the young, especially the innocent, a millstone being tied around their necks. Having said that, the question that we need to keep in our minds is, what is the standard by which we judge the heinousness of those crimes? And I suggest to you that it is the standard of the Christian faith. It's Christianity that tells us what, and natural law, tells us how heinous it is for anyone in power to abuse a vulnerable person. So this is not a rejection of Christianity, it's a rejection of the abuse of Christianity, the failure
of false
of vocations.
Christians, in a way, one
right.
could say.
Yeah. And I guess I am thankful for the fact that a lot of these recent cases that we're hearing about are really old cases. Mm-hmm. There are a few new cases that have come up, at least in the United States. Most of these have occurred 20 or 30 years ago.
And to get back to where we started, which is our central theme,
yes.
you preach, therefore, you don't preach free markets, you preach
no.
the gospel,
right,
but
right.
Do you find a way to sort of thread that in, and do your parishioners come to you with that? And
well, yes, of course, you know, parishioners come to you with a lot of different things, but I have to be very clear, you know, that there is a distinction between the core doctrine, dogma of the church on the moral kinds of questions we've talked about, doctrinal issues, and the more prudent application of the principles of Catholic social teaching. The Catholic Church doesn't offer, or the Christian Church doesn't offer, an economic system. The Bible doesn't teach Misesian economics over Keynesian economics, or the reverse. So these are prudential questions. That's why I may draw analogy, I may use stories, but I never politicize or put forth my prudential ideas and conclusions as though they were the official dogma of the church.
And one, we'll end on this one
too,
irony.
Too many on the left have done that.
Yes, well, I was going to, let's get to the left, because one thing that struck me, made me smile, is you hobnobbed with Jane Fonda in her leftist days, but she became an entrepreneur, very successful.
Yes.
If you saw her today, you might have a chance, maybe you'd try to convert her, go all the way and say, Jane, I'd like to, you know, come to Mass or what? I mean, how far would you, have you met her since? Or?
No, I haven't. A friend of mine met her and said, do you remember Robert Sirico? And she said, no, I don't remember that name. Of course, I was a Bob Sirico in those days. I'm sure if we sat down, I would give her the settings that we were in, and she would remember it immediately. There were too many instances that we were together.
But it might take you a while to convert her.
Well, it might. You know, people are free. They can, if she would be willing to reason on these questions,
who knows?
We'd have a very interesting conversation. Why don't you arrange the
well,
conversation?
Well, I'll try. In the meantime, I'll tell people to read Defending the Free Market. It's excellent, Father. Thank you very much.
It was fun to write. And good to be with you.
Same here. Thank you. Father Robert Sirico was our guest this week on the Free Markets series of the World Show. He's written a book called Defending the Free Market. He's also president of the Acton Institute, which he founded. That's where you can reach him or find out about this book. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.